And welcome to the Dice and Screaming Podcast.
Ow!
Oh, hey, you're back. Hey, welcome. Hey, Mike. Hey, everybody. Mike's here. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing much better. I do, in fact, exist. Do not listen to those rumors or blurry photos on the internet. I was not seen outside of McDonald's in
Mike Squatch
in Lodi, California. disappearing into the desert. That is entirely untrue. Nor was I spotted in the woods of New Jersey, dragging a body back into the forest. That was not me. So whatever cryptid rumors you may have heard, they are all false. I'm fine. Expect no less.
Yeah.
From the unwanted catharsis of gaming podcasts. Boy. No! Change is bad! Leave me alone. I was happy not knowing myself.
Oh.
Yeah, I got a little manic edge. Yeah, they've been working me pretty hard. Thus, last week's absenteeism. I have to admit, this season of the year does tend to be the hardest working time for me nowadays. Used to be the peak of summer. Now, Mike is very hard to reach during the heart of holiday season. So it is what it is, but I'm surviving and prospering in spite of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we had I had to do a solo cast last week. Got a little feedback on it. People were pretty contrite about how it was like very congenial, kept it relatively non-political. I think I spilled the beans right at the end where I felt where I landed on that. But I wanted to just nail down the lingering legend of, was Kissinger, did he play diplomacy? Because diplomacy would seem like something totally Kissinger would be into. And no.
It's fascinating that gaming was in the periphery of that Washington crowd. Although it does not surprise me. When you also consider the origins of the game propaganda.
Yeah, I mentioned that with Lauren Green and several other.
Which I own a copy of that, a vintage issue of it, because it's such a wonderful prize. I mean, it is,
it brought critical thinking.
Yeah.
Into
a sense
a
of
game.
Whimsy in gaming attached to critical thinking exercises. So there was a pretty highbrow crowd playing that stuff at that time. As opposed to just nerds, guys, I've got my little pocket protector with my extra pens, my mechanical pencil, I'm here to war game. Like, those were not the only people playing interesting board games. Board gaming itself, it had a richer level of involvement than it's given credit for. And my dad, who was like Air Force pilot and all of that, he had a couple of fantastic board games from the golden age of 1960s board games. And, I grew up around them, and Stocks and Bonds is not your most interesting game ever, but I gotta say, for a bunch of guys who were like jocks, as people would see them, if you're looking at the Top Gun crowd, it's surprising that they have these, complex, fascinating, thoughtful board games. So yeah, 100% plausible. If he never played diplomacy, I'm still sure that Henry Kissinger was cognizant of and peripheral to considerable board games.
Yeah, I don't think he really did. I think it's a nice legend. It's one of those things that it's too good not to be true. But in this case, there's just no supporting evidence. And that we landed pretty squarely on that. But I wanted to recap on the part of people gave me some compliments about being very contrite and reserved in my thoughts about him as a person or a politician or whatever, statesman I have. I think I have the utmost respect and definitely would look at the ideas of how he conducted himself, even if I did not agree with any of his methods or the outcomes, or it was even completely hostile to how he approached it. I have to have complete respect. The man played like a pro. So, yeah, I would definitely say, like, hey, he didn't need to play diplomacy because basically how he conducted statescraft was nice guys finished last, and he was not a nice guy. And that's it. So, that said, we push that aside. I wanted to also make mention that one of the things you bring up is fascinating about some of the discussions is there's always been a shame culture associated with gaming, and that's just not how it is. I mean, I was reading World War II history, as you well know, in the Pacific, that 4 months after things kind of settled down, I think it was after the Battle of Santa Cruz, they put a Fletcher Pratt table and started playing Fletcher Pratt naval war games on Guadalcanal.
Hmm.
Well, they, of course, are living the real events.
Now, by way of explanation, for those who are the uninitiated, the Fletcher Pratt table, that is basically like the equivalent for war gamers of having an Olympic swim pool.
Right.
The difference between like, oh, you're going to be in a pool. No, here's an Olympic pool with all of the specs and requirements necessary for this maximum level of performance. So, yeah, this is the environment that you would need to do appropriate and accurate wargaming. And that would be the Fletcher Pratt table. So,
yeah, for naval wargaming.
Yeah, that it was.
It's weird that they, you know, here they are, they're watching ships be sunk in Iron Bottom Sound. Battleships and cruisers and destroyers just going down by the dozens. And yeah, they still wanted to war game.
Like
ships blowing the crap out of each other.
Ah, man. I'm not actually surprised, though. Because,
frankly, well, escapism fantasy simulationism is still escapist fantasy, if you want to look at it from a certain point of view. But,
and in the case of wargaming, it's also simultaneously tactical practice. So, we took a soaking last week. How about if during this session we thoughtfully give some time?
Yeah, but this was mostly by the pilots.
What could we have done? Yeah,
from the Cactus Air Force. So we're familiar with those cats, and they were ragtag crew. But yeah, they wanted to blow off some steam. That's besides playing games of AC Ducey, backgammon, high stakes poker. Fletcher Pratt was also in there. So I think that also did a lot. It changed a lot of stuff. There's also a funny story that the...
It does give me a moment to mention that people forget that while they perceive, pilots as like daredevils and things of that nature, they're actually pretty much uniformly amazing at math. Aeronautics is not it's not a chump skill. Okay. This is hard science. So these are guys who can rock a slide rule and also kick ass at the same time. That, that's some tough freaking nerds. Okay. So yeah, you see these weird intersections of gaming mentality and what might be considered nerdery neck deep in the middle of a culture that is perceived as the exact opposite of that. So I love it because I grew up seeing that in person. You know, here's a guy who is a terrific engineer and, you know, a heck of a bean counter. And yet, you know, I've flown in multiple combat zones and around the world for 20 years. So yeah, that strange intersection of nerdery and badassery. It's hard for people to wrap their minds around.
Yeah, there was an interesting story, kind of funny. There was an actual admiral that played, and his staff that played Fletcher Pratt at tournaments. And I mean, he was a four-star admiral back in the 20s. I can't politely recall his name, and I probably should have done my due diligence before starting, but this is one of those things you just stumble over. Anyway, they went up against some women who were playing, and these women were fashion designers and seamstresses, and they were very good at measuring, and since you could only eyeball in Fletcher Pratt rules, they exactly knew the distance between the ships and would accurately call them out, plot their firing positions, and sank his ships before he even got a second salvo off. They exchanged salvos, and most of his ships were devastated because they were calling it out 36 inches. Oh, that's 48 inches. And hitting him every time. And
ladies, would you like a job?
Of course, that was very rarefied for that one. But yeah, anyway, yeah, Fletcher Pratt was a big game. There was also some others. But when diplomacy broke out, it didn't use dice. And that was, for a lot of people, a big change. It was different than other war games because the only dynamic you had to enforce any of the rules was actual human trust and interaction, which is a whole thing in and of itself. That was it. You know, how do you get people to, how do you enforce the agreements made between two players? In other words, you don't. That's it. If a person is duplicitous or untrustworthy, then, of course, that is its own consequence. The rules, there's no rules for that.
If they yet there are other players for that, which,
yeah,
lesson learned. Okay, welcome to life. Not everybody's being entirely forthcoming with you. Gosh, sometimes when it serves people's advantage, they say things that are not entirely accurate.
Or may betray you at the least opportune moment.
The onus of being thoughtful about how much you wish to be exposed to risk is on you. Like, caveat emptor. You as the other player, like, can I be absolutely sure he's telling me the truth?
No.
Do I want to strip my defenses in order to prepare for an offense based on the comforting belief that this person will have my back and will prevent me from suffering any consequences while I wildly overextend myself? Let me think carefully about that. Now, you're dealing with a person who has built up a sterling reputation of trust and, like, literally has come through for you again and again and has never done anything to betray you, then perhaps this is a good gambit.
Backstab you. Then.
Yeah. Now, for them, this is an opportunity of, like, if you've spent the entire game building a sterling reputation for exactly this one moment, and this, like, this is your masterstroke, which is, yes, it has taken an entirety of, like, 52 rounds of play to reach this moment where you wildly overextend yourself and I absolutely invade you while your forces are completely committed elsewhere. So, and you're out of the game after having inflicted as much harm on my remaining enemy as possible because I'm going to rock and win this. Yeah. But you should be thinking about that. The onus is on you. And there's a thing to be learned there about regular life.
Well,
diplomacy, the role-playing game, MMORPG style, non-virtual.
Well, the LARP. That's, if nothing else, you could say that, well, was Kissinger involved in diplomacy? Yeah, he was LARPing. Granted, but not in a pretend way. He was actually playing real world, real life, high stakes risk or diplomacy game with no rules.
I was just going to, as a final addendum, the passing of Kissinger overshadowed a far, far greater loss to the world. The passing of Shane McGowan of the Pogues, was just like literally. A modern poet laureate to Ireland, the Bob Dylan of Irish punk.
Oh, I'd say he far surpassed Bob Dylan.
Hey, I have a lot of respect for Bob Dylan's early work. I feel he's a great lyric poet. But, you know, this is like an Irish Tom Waits. I may be dropping too many terms that too many people won't get.
Well, if you don't know who Tom Waits is, well, you're in for a treat. Go look him up. Anyway,
going out west.
Which, you had a good home and you left. All right. So, yeah, good episode for Solo. Definitely thanks to everybody who gave me some feedback on it. Definitely head pats and, thumbs up. That's what I eat. attention. That's how I do. So some other news around here. Oh, yeah, it's that time of year. Humble Bundle's back. And this time, Paizo's doing it again. Second edition Legacy Bundle. If you don't have some of these books, it's a good one to get into. Probably may either have the physical copies or whatever. But
this is your window period to get a very low-cost launch into Pathfinder 2E.
Yeah, okay. Almost 464 bucks. Well, almost exactly 464 bucks at just under $50.
Yeah.
So get in there, get yourself, you know, you can get some of the Lost Omen guides that were not included in some of the other Legacy bundles, Humble Bundles, Legacy, and also Catalyst Games, makers of Shadowrun and Battletech. They're offering a Shadowrun reprint of the first edition rulebook, and it's kind of fell a little bit on the ground because people say, well, you can go get a print on demand from DriveThruRPG for $11.64. But the fact that they're bringing it back to the stores for $35, $40 is going to be, or probably $50 by the time they get done with it. What am I talking about?
Well, yeah, modern large hardcover prices are they are now.
the frog in the throat. Yeah, that's going to be hitting out. We haven't got the full cost yet, but yeah, you can, if you don't have a copy of the first edition Shadowrun, then go ahead. Some people are complaining, and I've been waiting to see what Catalyst has said, because they're putting this out and then not supporting seemingly some of the problems with the sixth edition rules, but you know, hey.
Do you feel like it's more of a memento moment where they're putting out something that, like, here's the origin story, man. Have a look at what this was. We still want you to go forth and play what is now. But, like, that first edition, like, there's just...
It's not well put together. Yeah. It is well organized, I will say, and laid out. There's not...
Yeah, I'm not... I think... I get you. It's the wrong term to say that it was poorly put together. It was nicely laid out. However, while they did divide the sections and the things that comprise the game into neatly separated sections, okay, that part was beautifully done. Some of the rules, as written, were clunky. The mechanics were difficult for a lot of people to adapt to. And, like, this was a major deficit. It was one of the big holdbacks that I think diminished the enjoyability of Shadowrun, which I'm still saying, great game, and we had a blast playing it. But they have done wonders with the system since then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they've done a fantastic job putting it together. But for those who want the memory, like, if you want to wade into Shadowrun 1, much like going for the D&D DM's Guide Player's Handbook First Edition style, it's a bumpy road, but you will have fun.
Yeah, I have the 2050 adaptation for 4th edition. I like that one a lot because it takes the best of both worlds, you know, a better system. But
I'm just looking forward to, you know, more moments. I feel like we're going to have a lot more moments in our life where the science fiction games we were playing in our youth, you know, in the faraway, distant future year of 2037. Uh-oh. Where's my flying car?
You ain't going to get one. Because people. But anyway, yeah, so that's something that Catalyst is coming out with. And also, they're giving out... They have an open call right now for submissions for your Battletech stories for their Shrapnel magazine. And if you're familiar with Shrapnel, a lot of the rising stars in their publications department, which is, yes, mostly digital these days, have come from the pages of, so to speak, the digital pages of Shrapnel. So if you have a Battletech story that you want to tell, whether it's about your own unit or your experiences or something completely dreamed up, like a mobile bodega merchant serving members of the periphery, hard scrabble, a little merchant group trying to make eke a living, There you go. There's a good example right there of a good story that you get out there, and you know who you are who came up with that. So I thought that's it's good to get out there and get that out into the open. So there's your opportunity there. And also, going back to Paizo, Scoured Stars Adventure Path is getting a hard pack. And this is from their Starfinder Society organized play. So this is an important one because for the first time, not the last time, from my understanding, it's the first time that the organized play has actually gotten a hardback adventure path published. So it'll take you from levels 1 through 15. So yeah, if you're in, you know, your last gasp of Starfinder before 2 years, the new edition, if you're like, oh, I don't want to play Starfinder because we've got 2 years, guys, get out there. Yeah. Because next year, we're going to see the beta, and then we're going to have to wait till the year after that to see the full release. So. So still plenty of time for Starfinder. You
know. Oh my God, yes. And man, what a time we had. I enjoyed our Starfinder campaign. Probably almost inappropriately so. I inflicted a lot of emotional distress on my DM, who is sitting across from me right now.
I think that the session zero fell on deaf ears, but you know, that's...
Well, I know you were going for serious, and I was going for, like, manic joyful. And those two things do not always intersect well. Although, I want to say, I feel like during the course of that campaign, we did manage to, like, make those two things. Like my peanut butter got into your chocolate, and your chocolate got into my peanut butter. But the final product was pretty freaking awesome. Okay, it's nothing anybody planned, but
a lot of good times can be had if a few of the players are playing for jokes. As long as the objective is still, however it's presented, is just there, and that's it. It's you adapt to the situation, and the song remains the same. The music's going to keep on rolling.
Oh yeah, I was, you know,
you
was
may
there.
Want to be, you may have been there to listen to some Ian Anderson flute rock, but I was going to be playing straight metal from the early '80s. So there, you're going to hear that, and you know you want, yeah, but I want to hear some. All right, some flute rock can happen.
And I did come to finish missions. Okay, the team play was still in place, but I learned to like you inject the levity into it in places where it's useful and does not harm the overall plot of the game. Because the art of comic gaming, a lot of it, much like regular comedy, timing is everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. What is it? tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Comedy, yeah.
Yeah, you do not want to rush this process. Like, yeah, oh, hey, you know, If we screw this up, the campaign goes down the toilet. Yeah, now's not the time. However, you know, rampant smartassery, even during combat. Hey, if you're finishing missions, buddy, you got warlock blood, okay? Or no, you've got tiger's blood. You're a warlock.
But yeah, you're a warlock. Well, okay. Turn a bunch of cigarette butts into a steak, mashed potato dinner. All right.
Yeah. I'm winning. Which, that is hauntingly appropriate for Farstucker. His entire character arc was basically a Charlie Sheen snapshot.
Redemption arc. Yeah.
All right. That having been said, that's all the news that fits. You know, like we got our updates in. We're looking forward to what's about to happen here because we're launching in to our examination of classes in a meta sense and the evolving amount of information that is available to us about what people choose and, you know, a little supposition on our part, a little inquiry into why do people choose what they choose? Mm. You know, what makes a popular class? What are the qualities that a player is looking for? AI and analytics and things like that have allowed us to data mine in a way that did not exist in our younger years. Like this information was more experientially acquired. Like you only found it locally at your tables or in your little online click. You could glean some of this data, but most of it was a mystery to us, and it certainly was an aggregate
wrapped in an enigma.
You didn't get this like, hey, we have the results from 300,000 people. Now we do. And we're going to be looking at that.
Yeah, well, before, I mean, Wizards and TSR tried several times to make surveys and find out, but they weren't very forthcoming. I mean, there was a second edition survey that I remember that they put Dragon Magazine back when they were transitioning to second edition fully, and they wanted to know what your thoughts were. I filled it out, and they did come out with some of the data, but not all of it. And again, I was always kind of suspicious. Like, why didn't you just show the data? Like, give everything, like, what the average, you know, they gave stuff like the average age and what everybody's favorite class was and things like that, just to give you some background. But they weren't very forthcoming on some of the things about, like, why do you like the initiative system in AD&D? Or is weapon speeds important to you? And they never said any of those small points. There was other ones too. But, you know, I was curious about the answer. Like, did people like that? Did they not like that? I mean, I'm neutral towards it because that's just the way the game is played. So be it.
Yeah, some of it we accepted face value, but there were a few things that...
Yeah, when you showed us an improvement, if you show me a way to improve it, yeah, you know, I'm willing to sit down and listen.
It streamlines speed of play and...
quality of life stuff, you know, if it makes it, you know, if it's...
If the DM is doing less...
Do you drink your beer out of a can or glass? Both. Okay, so I can do both of it, but if you like to...
You had me at beer.
Yeah. So if you're just saying like combat, yeah, I like combat, but do
I'm not a tough sell. I'm not the toughest audience you've ever faced in the room. Dude, they had beer. I what did you expect?
Right, but there is a time and a place, and I think that in certain conditions, drinking beer out of a glass is a little bit of a sign of who you are. But
especially if the glass is a skull.
Sure. Yeah. I have, you know, many fun shaped beer signs, but some of them are fun to drink out of and others, well, not so much, but you know, that's what it is. But the fact is those are made for effect versus the others. And you make a lot of good points that we never got to know what those numbers were. What were some of those questions? What were the answers to them? And why didn't they show up? Well, now we have a larger access to one of the questions we're asking about classes. And so we're going to give an overview of how classes are played. And we're going to do a side-by-side with that with Baldur's Gate 3 popular classes so far. So promise we're going to make this interesting, so hopefully you'll stick around. I mean, you made it this far, right? So I mean, what else do you got to lose? Another half hour?
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, you've already touched the flypaper. It only, like, you know, at this point, own it, work with it, you know, because it's
stick around.
It's there. See what this we did is there? Totally happening.
Yeah, so all right, we're gonna take a brief break and we'll be back with our topic, popular D&D classes. All right, catch you later. All right, we're back. And yeah, we mean what we said. We are here to talk about D&D classes. But before we truly get into it, see where how we're fooling you, we're going to talk about what's up for next week. So give those dice a roll, Grandma Astro Gallimancer, and tell us what lays in store for us.
Behold the clickety-clack of the math rocks. All right. The Astrogallomancer has divined the future through the power of gazing into tumbling dice. And he sees the Dungeoneer's Survival Guide in our near future.
Oh, wow. An orange spine.
It's a contentious book. Okay. Yeah. And yet, it has value. There is material in it that is extremely useful and extremely well thought out, but it is also burdened by unnecessary fluff, and thus the controversy. We're going to be looking at the ups, the downs, the pluses, the minuses of the Dungeoneer's Survival Guide. So there will be, you know, some stuff you may read this and you think, hey, you know, I could actually harvest this for future games. And that's an accurate statement. But you're also going to hear some stuff that, like, really? They just really wanted to pad the page count that bad? Yeah. Mm. And that is going to be accurate, too.
So, yeah, grab yourself a copy of Dead Milkman's Born to Love Volcanoes, and we'll be exploring the Dungeoneer Survival Guide next week. So that's what's coming up. So now we're bringing you in for a landing. Here you go. Here's the LSO with
it's
the paddles.
It's topic time.
Yep. Here you go. You know, coming in. Bring it in. So we talked about D&D classes. So here we are. So what are we going to talk about? Well, of course, with all D&D classes. What we're specifically speaking about is there was a 538 poll, and there was a D&D
Beyond.
Yeah, thank you. Words. The D&D Beyond poll. And also, look at Baldur's Gate 3 data mining and seeing what people are playing. And we're going to compare those. But we're also going to make a little talk and about how the classes have changed and why they are so popular. So, yeah, let's start. This is a big one. So let's start with the D&D Beyond poll, which is includes subclasses. But the D&D Beyond poll basically was a voluntary poll. So we only got the enthusiasts who actually decided that they wanted to participate in this one. But what we got, this information is telling. So go ahead. What is our first class? What is the most popular class in D&D?
Number one with a bullet. Deriving from its ancient predecessor, the fighting man. The fighter.
Human fighter. Yeah, human fighter.
Well, you know, the fighter class with 13% participation rate, which places it at the top of the heap for the most frequently chosen. And the most frequently chosen subclass for fighter, the champion. I am a little personally astonished that the battle master is not more popular than it is. But you know what? I gotta say, I kind of understand the choice. I've played a lot of fighters who were straight line fighters. Fight guy who fights.
I'm a guy who fights. I'm a fighter. I'm gonna fight you. Don't give me some room. So right after that, of course, is no surprise, the rogue.
The rogue.
Yes,
with
rogue.
The traditional thief subclass leading. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No frills, none of your little arcane trickster nonsense. Or
that's like, right.
You know, the assassin and the arcane trickster came in about equal as like alternate choices. But dominating the class, the true thieves thief.
Now we're going to get back to those, break it down. We're just going to go down now. Well, you start with the fighter, and then there's the rogue. Right after that, it's the warlock slash wizard cleric. You know, okay, because those kind of blend together with barbarian also as well. And I can understand those. But then the rest of the classes kind of, you know, follow them. But at the tail end, the very end, it's the druid.
Yeah. And
what did the druid ever do to you?
I feel like I might have been partially responsible for that. Like, I've been talking smack about druids everywhere I've ever gone for years, and now I'm feeling a little bad. Like, you know, like I bashed them so hard. And maybe it was undeserved, you know? Maybe do you think I was too harsh? If I play a druid sometime soon, you know, I'll try to be a good example and show that, like, I didn't mean that. That was mostly for comic effect. I just, although, oh my gosh. No, I'm sorry. It's my worst impulses. I still want to play a druid and name them the Druid and just play it Jeff Bridges style.
Some homeless guy out in the forest with his pet badger, Steve.
Yeah, he's basically wearing a bathrobe.
Made of his own hair. I'm not kidding. He's left.
Sells arts and crafts on the outside edge of town to, you know, make a little spare change.
Yeah.
Has bees growing in his beard.
You know, I'm here for it.
No, I've been terrible to druids, and man, where's the druid love? Like 6% for druids.
Right, and so we're going to look at those, but first, let's talk about the fighter. Now, throughout the years, and we're going to take peel back the onion here. We're going to go to Baldur's Gate comparison in just a little bit here. But the first half here, we're going to talk about just this D&D Beyond poll. Now, this was voluntary, so obviously you're only going to get your enthusiasts. Your casual gamer is not going to be included in this. It's like William F. Buckley snobbery is fully on display. Yeah. Your casual gamer is not really interested in participating in such polls because they're paltry, parsimonious pussyfooting. It's just not in their nature to participate, so therefore their opinions are thus discounted.
And if you call me a crypto-fascist again, I'll punch you right in your face.
I wish you would have said that.
No, he did.
Really? He really said he was going to punch somebody in the face for calling him a crypto.
Yeah, during the live interview.
Oh, all right. I missed that one. Wow, I'll have to look that one up. Yeah, so, which, you know, hey, I get it. Nonetheless, we've really been on the 70s vibe lately, haven't we? We need to tune it up. I want to get back in the 80s. So, yeah, let's talk about the fighter class and why it's so popular, because a lot of times, especially in the early editions, your entry level was the fighter. It's a guy with a weapon from Conan to King Arthur, fighter, or Lancelot, maybe I should say.
Yeah, the fighter offers you the greatest possible range of images and the smallest number of limitations. Okay, it doesn't come with a whole lot of fancy frills, special powers, but in all of its incarnations, it represents something that people can connect to very easily. And it doesn't come with the absolute crap load of calculations that you may have to make or tactical, you know, considerations.
Yeah.
You can always fall back on a fighter to, like, I charge, and then I'm going to stab that thing repeatedly.
Over and over until it's dead. Right. And so, therefore, I think the fighter has always been a predominant choice because a lot of new players as well. And again, in my little attempt there to channel the William F. Buckley snobbery, casual players may start with a fighter. And at first and second edition, and especially in the basic expert editions that I'm very fond of, the fighter is a good choice, okay? It's never wrong to play a fighter. But
I play a ton of them.
It's a lot of fun. We got a lot of subclasses out of the fighter. The Paladin Ranger. Definitely now we can look back and say with, yeah, Barbarian, come in here. Bring it in. Bring it in, Barbarian. Yeah, you're part of the subclass.
Come on, buddy.
Get in here. Get in here. You're not your own class. You're part of us. Oh, okay.
One of us. One of us.
And, you know, the Cavalier, I mean, I've always looked at that as in the 1.5E, excuse me, the Unearthed Arcana is like, I like the concept of the as that as a subclass, but you know, aren't we already doing that kind of with Paladin anyway? But okay, I get it. Here's the whole jerk ass buffoon on a horse who thinks he's better than everybody else because, you know, my dad totally owns a kingdom.
Oh, man.
So there's that guy, the Cavalier, but now he's just a subclass. So yeah, fie on you. Yeah, go there. You're like the guy who peaked in college and never stopped. You know, that's it. You just, you know, you peaked early, you plateaued, and that's all you're known for. It's like, my dad totally owns a kingdom, dude. Well, I've got this bitchin' horse.
Oh, no.
So yeah, the Cavaliers, yeah, among those, but kind of got dropped, but the Barbarian, yeah, Barbarian stayed around because Barbarian's damn fun. And it's also an 8%. So we talk about the 8%ers, you know, there's only, let's see, there's only three of them. That's Barbarian, the Cleric, and the Wizard.
Yeah, with coming the, in after the Rogue.
Yeah, well, after the Rogue is the Warlock at 9%, and then the Sorcerer, Monk, Bard, Paladin, and Ranger at 7%, with the poor Druid.
6%. Measly percent. Which, honestly, all of these numbers are very close.
Yeah.
As you look at the D&D Beyond poll, and you give consideration to the fact that it's the more, like, hardened core of players, you do get the impression that while there is a drift towards fighters and rogues, the overall reality is that, you know, the other choices are surprisingly even.
Yeah. Meaning that,
like, the players are willing to move from class to class without a main.
You know? Yeah.
Which I gotta say, I kind of entirely connect with, because that eventually became my player legacy, which
yeah, if Wizard. You look
at the first few years that I played, fighters dominated the landscape. But if you look at everything over the last 25 to 35 years as an aggregate, as an examination of the whole, yeah, I've played almost everything.
Yeah. I mean, Wizard, we've got to conclude an 8% club as Wizard. Yeah, sorry. Right after the Warlock, of course. But yes, spellcasters are very dominant in this. You know, Cleric, Wizard, Sorcerer, Warlock, they're all right there too. So, you know, the spellcasters are also well represented and very close. And I think it's also telling that in the Wizard you see the School of Evocation is at 40%, School of Necromancy 10%. But Divination still shows up in the top three.
Evocation.
Well, yeah, of course. What do? I cast fireballs. How many do you got? All of them. That's all I memorize. Just fireballs.
Oh,
occasionally, every once in a while, a lightning bolt.
Still more varied than the Warlock.
Say it.
What do you cast? Eldritch Blast.
I don't want to say it. You know what I'm going to do. Can we not make me say it? No, you got to say it every time.
I cast Eldritch Blast.
Yeah!
Oh, man. So, I'm sorry. I had a negative reaction to the Warlock early on, which was like, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You're excited to play an Edgelord mage that has very few spells, but gets to do those very few spells a lot. That's it. That was your, like, the real sales point on this is clearly the Edgelord background.
Yeah, you couldn't be bothered to play a sorcerer. I'm a
dark power, which is in my backstory. But I'm also totally useless, except for my Eldritch Blast.
Yeah, you couldn't even have played a sorcerer.
I'm not actually opposed to the sorcerer.
Well, the sorcerer is a great class, but we'll get into that in a minute.
Little more variety in spells available.
Yeah, but the cleric's also very strong showing here with...
I have no beef with clerics.
Well, of course. Clerics are a lot of fun to play.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, you have the backing of a supreme ally that potentially, on a divine intervention role, can show up and save your bacon. However,
yeah, and I never had any disconnect with the idea that a cleric was a party saver. Because, man, how many times is my fighter butt pulled out of the fire? Like, it's like, how many hit points you got left, Mike? I'm rocking both of them, bro. Little hand up anytime now. I am back in the fight.
Like that meme with the truck with no bed left, no... rear tire. It's just on three wheels and it's still going down the road. How many hit points you got left? One! But that's all I need. I'm still combat efficient. 100% combat efficiency right here, buddy.
Yeah. It has not in any way lowered my weapon damage. Okay? That part isn't hurt.
No bed. The trunk is, or the hood's off. No fender. One fender on the left side. And the windows are all out. So yeah, that's all you've got left. It's just a steering wheel and a gear shift and somewhat a functional transmission and engine. That's all I need, baby. I'm gonna need some time out after this combat to recover a few hit points. How about a long rest?
Hey, and you know what? Let's give the credit where it's due. You can tell the evolution of the monk in terms of gaming, because class-wise, when we were early players, when the monk first started becoming available for regular play, not one of the strongest choices you could make, and it was not very popular.
Well,
unarmed and mostly harmless.
The monk has been revised almost more times in the early editions than any other class.
Yeah.
Except for different ones. There was the Dragon Magazine, I think, which was superlative. I think
yeah. It
was very good. But I'll agree with Tim Kask on this one. It was a mistake. It should never have been put in, and they tried to take it out and put it in Oriental Adventures where it supposedly belonged, which there's a whole thing about that. But we're going to move past that and just say that, like, hey, when they finally got their act together, the monk was out as a second edition for the most part. They did kind of bring it back a little bit. But third edition just said, yeah, we got monks. Yeah, well, they were a mistake. No. Now they're not. And now monks, for a lot of people,
they have been balanced handsomely way that is respectful not only to other classes, but to the monk itself. Okay, they have been blended into the quilt in a way that is appropriate now. I'm very okay with where they're at as a class. They did not get what they deserved early on, and they kind of waffled back and forth between being OP. We're attempting to correct how lame they are, and now we've OP'd them. And now we've nerfed them to reduce the level of OP. Blah, 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 blah. Well, the struggle is over. I feel like they're in a very good spot.
Yeah, right they've now. Been, I think, 3.5 in Pathfinder 1E, as well as the new edition.
And this baseline edition. 7%, like...
Shows that it's right up there.
Yeah, it is, like, alongside the Paladin and the Ranger and the Bard and the Sorcerer.
And let's face it, we don't have to talk much about the Ranger or Paladin. They speak for themselves.
Everybody the classics.
Everybody's enjoyed them. But the one, we'll get back to the Sorcerer and the Wizard in a few minutes.
I will say this on the tidbit on the Paladin.
They've
rewired the Paladin so that, like, the Paladin can also be the anti-Paladin.
Yes.
I mean, if your oath of vengeance, like, I am here on behalf of my dark deity, I have sworn vengeance against everything that I despise, I will destroy all of the enemies of my... Just, if you want to rock it, you can rock it.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, the anti-Paladin's always been an option, and I think it should be an option, to be honest. The oncoming editions, as it's moved through the years, the Paladin has seen a lot of changes, but it's still pretty much the same experience, no matter what edition or version you're playing. So we're going to always include Pathfinder in our comparisons to D&D. So even though they've tried to become less adjacent and more distant to the roots of D&D, they're still open. This came from the game created by Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson. So you guys can relax. Now, you know who I'm talking to if you feel called out. Now let's go to talking about the players. 13%, that's telling. That's 5% above the next the nearest peer, which is the Warlock at 9%.
Well, 4%.
4%, I'm sorry.
The Warlock.
But yeah, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
4-6% ahead of almost everybody else. Okay, wow.
The nearest competitor is the Rogue. And so we've talked about the fighter, but what about that 11% Rogue? Yeah, the Rogue doesn't want you to know how often it's played. It's not what it's here. They're not here to draw attention to themselves.
Better left in the shadows.
Mm. And that's it. Is
you don't need to know what we do in the shadows. Sorry, I can't help myself.
Let's just put this right where it belongs. Like, look, we call it the Rogue now, but a long time ago, in days of yore, it was called the Thief.
Yeah, for good reasons.
Yeah, you know, pickpockets. Hey, what do you think I got pickpockets for, huh?
Open just locks. Which, every lock that ain't locked when no one's around. Yeah, the Rogue was not the Rogue. The Rogue was the Thief.
Yeah, and I think that's epitomized in the first edition Player's Handbook picture of the Rogue. You know, the guy with barefoot... with just a pair of pants, holding a pouch in one hand and a dagger at the throat of presumably some type of merchant or rich, wealthy person in an alleyway. And that's the Thief. That's right, baby. You got dagger, you got money. You know, you look at this movie. He's just got pants on. You know, that's it. Because he woke up broke, naked, and confused in the back alley. You know, he picked up these PR skanks in the Golden Goblin Casino. Thought he was going to have himself a good time. And they roll him. Just gosh, him right in the back of the head. Roll him. Take everything he has. And so he has to use climb walls. He climbs up the walls, baby. Grabs himself a pair of pants from a laundry line. They don't even really fit. Look at him. He's trying to half hold him up. And then he sees this moot taking a leak, training the weasel in the alleyway. What is he doing? He sneaks up. He uses pickpockets to take his knife. Why? Because you got a dagger. You got money, baby. And that's it. He puts it to his throat. He says, give me your money or you give me a life. And look at him. He's just smiling about it because he knows. He knows he stole the guy's own dagger and is holding him up with his own weapon because that's a thief, baby. And yeah, so that's the guy, the mentality. You were a thief. You were kind of a dirtbag. Okay?
Yeah, there was no, he's a noble-hearted scout who goes out in front and eliminates potential threats.
And that's my cousin.
Yeah, none of that. No, it's this is the guy that, like, the party shakes him down at the end of every adventure.
Yeah, he holds upside down and all these coins and gems and magic items fall off. Where did these come from? I just picked them up. Hey, leave me alone.
That certainly explains why every single encounter that involved a chest that wasn't a mimic, we were only finding loose change.
And that brings us back to a previous
episode. Where did you hide that? You're not even wearing that many clothes.
That's right, but his defense...
That's a ruby the size of a robin's egg. Yeah, and my prostate's never felt better.
That's why his call sign is, if you got a dagger, you got money. Because you can get money anywhere. After getting slapped around by the party spider for withholding two potions of healing, you know, I almost died defending you from those mummies. Yeah, I know, it was great. What a sucker. But yeah, then they changed it to from the thief.
It's not a potion to cure disease, buddy. So I didn't see where it was going to do you any good.
Yeah, then they changed it to the rogue. And then they got...
The rogue...
It was more genteel.
Has a better connotation in terms of the wide nature of roguish characters, okay? This is where the mythology of media, which is a thing that we brush up against a lot on this show, the mythology of media and media products has given us magnificent rogues who were not just thieves, okay? They were not reluctant heroes per se. They weren't chiefly interested in personal gain and then decided to do nice guy stuff. There were classic rogues where you've got your Robin Hood sneaking about with a bow and breaking into the castle and rescuing the princess. And yeah, still capable of a sword fight and deeds of derring do, but not a classic heavy-hitting armored fighter. And as they developed the concept of the rogue into something a little more, accessible for gameplay.
A little bit more socially inclined. A little
more respectable, yeah. To, like, scouts and, adventurers.
Yeah,
and
adventurers primarily. But
that, I feel like it was a much deserved adaption. So I never had any beef with why do you call it a rogue? I get it.
Look, all joshing aside, a lot of people felt that if you had the title thief, then you should do something to be a thief. You know, I don't hear you talking about paladin doing paladin stuff, but I do thief stuff. Everybody wants to be an adventurer until it's time to do the thief stuff. And then they're out. Yeah, I find the traps. You also hide in shadows and pick our pockets. You know what?
Comes with the territory. No, I did notice that was mostly a player problem. The first excuse was, the title of my class is Thief. That means I steal from you. I'm just playing my class. I'm just playing my class when I cut your head off and I mount it on a pole with a little sign on, on the little sign hanging off of it that says, this is what happened to thieves around here. Or better still, I'll write it. It'll say, he stole from his own party. And that's how the story ended.
Aww.
Like the severed head of the guy couldn't keep his hands to himself. We'd have had your back if you went into town and you robbed like a bunch of widows and orphans. We'd have still been like, yeah, dude, like we'll hide you. We'll hide you in the back of the wagon.
Can you just not
under some turnips and we'll smuggle you out of town?
Could you just steal from the rich and give to the poor yourself? I mean, like, what happened to that guy?
Like, dude, you robbed those orphans for 11 copper pieces in the entire
town. That's right.
You did. That was not a good fiscal.
What were they
going
to spend it on? I'll put it to use.
Yeah. Now, we'd have had your back, but no, you robbed your own party, so now you die.
No.
A lot of arguments, a lot of gaming tables, circa the 1970s and 80s. While we sorted out that issue. The rogue, of course, kind of took that. You're like, no, your title is rogue. You're a rogue, but that does not
necessarily... I don't want to be a rogue. I want to be a thief.
Oh, you can be a guy who steals from his own party.
You can't. Because then you ain't going to play with anybody who isn't going to attack you when you they find out that they've been stolen from. but yeah, so you know what? The rogue is a great choice because you have a lot of versatility in how you want to play your character. If you want to hide and not an attack at the most opportune moments, this is a class for you. And for a lot of people, I think that they have done a great job of making the rules of sneak attack a lot more viable. You know, it used to be just the backstab, which, you know, pretty much had a negative connotation. You know, the backstabber. Ah, I'm the backstabber. Yeah, that's right, baby. You don't, you turn your back on me, I'm going to stab you because I got a dagger. I got money. Oh, okay. You know what he's going to say. Yeah. So that guy, he's pretty much, you know, regulated to not the dustbin of gaming history, but I think that's been put on a back burner a little bit. You can still play that guy. You can still play that mook of a thief who's just trying to get, you know, he's a good fella. I'm a good fella. You're going to like me. You know what? We're going to be friends.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Just based on that voiceover alone, I would have killed him in like round two.
I know.
I'd have shanked him just for quiet around the campfire at night.
You know?
I'm not going on an adventure with Carl.
Then he became a used horse salesman. Hey, can I interest you in a new horse? I bet I can. He's like, hey, Omar, I got a couple live ones here.
My horse is named Too Wicked.
You know where I'm going with it. Yeah, you know, that's who he became. He became a used horse salesman. You know what? I'm going to go talk to my manager. I'll see if I can help you out on this one. You ain't got 300 gold? I think we could swing this. You just sit right here. I don't even go anywhere.
Now, in our finish-up section, we'll be back for one more round.
Yeah.
As we, you know, cover...
Talk about the magic users.
Well, we've also got to pick up on the other studies that were done, which are wider in scale than the D&D.
Yeah, well, after we do the magic users and a little bit of the cleric, rest assured, we'll have plenty of time to do this. We're going to the next training, so it'll be a pleasant surprise for some of you.
Right? Yeah.
Just like the difference between a backstab and a sneak attack. They may sound different, but they feel all the same.
Well, they both hurt.
They will. So, yes, we'll abuse your ears, but just to say that, yeah, we'll come back with the magic users. We're going to take a brief break and replenish our supplies and then take a short rest. And we'll be right back. So, stick around. All right, and we're back. So, yeah, here we are bringing it home. And we're talking about, we had a lot of fun talking about how the rogue has transitioned. But the fighter, you know, the reason why we don't make a whole lot of jokes about the fighter is other than the one thing about D&D and Pathfinder's hit point allotment is the fact that, you know, you could be down to your last few hit points. And you're still 100% combat efficient. And I think that's one big thing about the fighter that people are, they're not afraid to go into combat with the fighter because, well, there's not a lot of penalties. But we also talk about, like, the barbarian is a bit of a different experience than the fighter. So, but we can bring that one to a later date. Well, but let's get
that's for those who really wanted to go the route of the warrior that is not from the hyper civilization that the rest of the party is likely from. You know, the wonder of the barbarian in its first incarnation in D&D, where it was broken away from the fighter. The wonder of it was, like, the incredible amount of hit points, okay? Just, that was the bait.
Mm.
Huge, ridiculous, record-breaking number of hit points that it just, you absolutely have to crush them. You made
Ranger Lords blush.
Yeah, you've got the hit points of a small European nation. And
gosh, I just wish I had that many.
You can't wear heavy armors and, you know, like the aversion to magical items. I have no truck with things of dark sorcery.
Yeah, you're regulated to a list of items, which if you choose a Viking background, are pretty much standard throughout the game.
Yeah.
I wear chainmail, I use shields, and I use broadswords, spears, axes, and daggers.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds like a really big drawback there, Ulf.
Yeah.
Well, I chose well.
Well, Yeah, but I'll be a while before I trust being around a mage. The smacks of evil.
Mm.
Do not like. Now, that having been said, the later iterations of the barbarian cooled their jets a little bit, brought them back down just a little, and let them interact with other players in a healthier way. Okay, now you have a person who does not have to murder the person trying to play a magic user the minute they meet them. No more at the table nonsense that basically, much like the Cavalier, the early iteration required that you be a complete jackass at every opportunity. I'm just playing my character, man.
I'm going to break these magic items that we're not going to use. If we wanted to sell them, well, maybe I will use them to gain experience points.
Yeah, that's okay when it's the leftover dagger plus one and we let you pay for it out of the party pot. But when you're like, oh man, I'm going to get so much if I snap this staff of the Archmagi.
I'm going to sacrifice at the door.
That's when the entire party's like, yeah, he's got to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, they got rid of that, but no, I don't, you know... Have you met the Frenzied Berserker from 3.5? All right. Yeah, getting along with others. But,
still some OP there, but...
You know, if Anger had a class, it would be the Barbarian. the Barbarian, angry and maladjusted, however you want to put it.
Rage! Yeah,
rage as a lifestyle. That's what the Barbarian is. And you know what? They've done a great job of utilizing mechanics that harness the classic trope of the Berserker. The wild, almost totemic warrior of that identifies heavily with a certain type of spirit animal, bear, wolf, raven, you know, whatever is necessary. Some type of predatory, dangerous, and sometimes dark animals. It makes a nice fantasy trope. It is, you know, the barbarian fits nicely in this paradigm, as well as the ranger, which, hey, you know, Aragorn. Basically, the Ranger class, as written, represents Aragorn out of the Lord of the Rings. You know, the ability to use crystal balls. Where did that come from? You know, and he can pick it up.
Well,
and,
yeah, we know. We know exactly where the Ranger
the druid is a druidic in part.
Schooled in lore, despite being of, like, spending a lot of time in the wilderness and yet schooled in, you know, very, very specific lore. That
it's druid magic user spells.
Yeah, it's a wonderful class that I enjoyed. I don't think
second edition took a little bit of that out of it and put the emphasis on the wilderness warrior and, you know, putting the range in the ranger, and then the ranger moved on. But to what it is today, which is a varied, it has, if you want to be the scout, the wilderness warrior, the guy who can go self-sufficient into the wilds and come out again alive. I mean, I think there's a little point I'm just going to land it here on before we move on, Ranger, that the Ranger, we don't really emphasize how dangerous the wilderness is when you have to bring your own provender and survive off the land. It is very rough, and even today, with all our modern equipment and abilities, people still go missing or are found later dead who are experts in their craft.
Yeah, not everybody is Bear Grylls. Okay, Bear Grylls, awesome ranger dude.
Well, yeah, when he has his camera crew behind him. He's awesome.
He'd probably do okay on his
own. I would say survival man.
Probably. Like, if he just shows up with nothing but a knife and
and a camera crew, but yeah, I get you, yeah, I know. I'm going to make fun of it because it's...
Well, I know it's all overplayed on the TV, but the guy has the basic skill set and understands.
Okay,
and it communicates that skill set to other people that, like, if you're out in this situation, here is a thing that you should never, ever do. Okay? I appreciate that. I take that at face value.
But you could also have a guy like Steve Irwin who talks to the animals, which we'll bring back in the point home on at the end of the spot to draw it. But now let's move on to magic users. Okay, so magic users used to be, okay, did you cast spells? You're a magic user. Okay, we're going to get that mook out of the way because I got one last attempt at comedy from him. Yeah, when you were a magic user back then, whether you're a sorcerer, a witch, or a warlock, you were a magic user. You just were a magic user. You have a spell book, you cast spells. You might have a backstory where you have a dark patron that gave you this spell book and the access to powers. Or you might have had...
I got debts! Wizard school, like the tuition is incredible.
You know how much?
I have to unlock the secrets of immortality because that's how long it's going to take to pay this back.
But one
my wizard thing, student loans are killing me, dude.
But one thing, the magic.
I'll never afford a tower at this rate.
Exactly. But one thing wizards had going for them continually was they couldn't use many weapons. A dagger, maybe a staff. A staff was their highest damage output weapon. And if you had visions of Gandalf holding off the Balrog with a sword, well, you were going to be sorely disappointed because you used a four-sided die for hit points, so you sucked. Not much lasting power. But anyway, the magic user was best represented by the robe-wearing, erudite, semi-academic that was seeped in arcane lore and the occult arts. And so there they were.
Merlin, John Dee.
Yeah. So you had kind of a... And they put on the back of that the mechanic of spellcasting, which was basically fire and forget. You prepared a spell, and then when you cast that spell, you no longer could cast that spell. You had a certain number of times you could cast spells, and you had to prepare each one in advance.
Yeah, this was... They tapped this concept from the fantasy books of John Vance, Jack Vance.
Jack Vance.
And they tapped it precisely because it was something that could be built upon and include reasonable limitations, mm-hmm. okay? That would restrict, like, I simply do this as much as I feel like, whenever I feel like.
Magic is just, it's like a wavelength that ties you into the greater cosmos and the universe. Hey, go play a druid.
Yeah.
Okay? If you're going to talk to me that stuff.
I can smell what you've been smoking.
Why do you got to come at me with all these negative vibes, man?
Yeah.
man, you're just crushing me with these negative vibes. I gotta go off. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that guy played a druid. But, yeah, magic was... They codified it. They structured it, put levels. They killed it.
Degrees of difficulty for the types of spells you could cast, with the more powerful and more dangerous spells being things that you were able to earn your way up to as you lasted in this class. And the term glass cannon has always come from the mage, because at higher levels, they were the most powerful characters in the game. In the early game, the devastating impact that they could have on play was unimaginable. They could annihilate cities, whereas the fighter's like, okay, yeah, look, we each picked a city, and I know we agreed they were going to destroy those two cities. Like, I've been at this for like 16, 17 hours now. My sword arm is exhausted. I've been hacking down all the women and the children and the city guards. And I got the first quarter of the city has been cleansed. And the mage is like, yeah, I completely finished annihilating that city. 15 hours ago?
I cast one spell. Yeah. The city was gone.
Yeah. It's buried beneath the sands of time now.
So yeah, it's gone.
That was the power gap. Of course, if they both fell off of a high roof, the fighter bounces a little on all those meaty muscles. Oh, man. Oh, that's killing me. Oh, but apparently not as bad as it's killing you, because you're dead as hell. Oh, look at that. It's mage mush. Street pizza. So the glass cannon term literally came from the fragility and immense power of the mage.
Second edition. Didn't do anything for magic users. It's pretty much still the same.
Mage or illusionist.
You know, you got kind of the specialty schools, and that's about it. You know, they took the illusionist concept
and said, what if everybody could do that? Like, specialize in a school and stop, like, making illusionists, because they're almost useless. As I learned the hard way with my first character.
Hey, illusionists can scare people with a dagger.
Astanun! You live in memory.
You're great.
Level 3 and dead.
Anyway. Yeah, but nothing really changed. And third edition introduced the sorcerer, which gave bloodlines and the idea that there was a draconic heritage in the mix of this one. And yeah, Pathfinder took it and ran with it and expanded the bloodlines to many different things. And yeah, so 5th edition picked that up and ran with as well. Probably somebody out there is going to be like, but 4th edition, yeah, I get it, but I didn't read 4th edition. Sorry, I'm not trying to.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of input on that because, look, whatever people may think, we do actually stay in our lane. Like, we're operating with what we do have some knowledge of.
Yeah, I'm not trying to diminish your fun. If you really enjoyed Sorcerers in 4th edition, yeah, I hear you that they were a blast, but. You know,
Sorcerer is a little better than the Warlock.
A little bit. There's some perks. You get some spells that fit into your bloodline.
Yeah.
Or your heritages, and it gives you a flavor, a specific flavor. But you have a finite number of spells, but you can cast them over and over again. You don't have to prepare for them. And then there's the Warlock, which, you know, you've already stated your opinions on it. So I'm going to give mine. So the Warlock was an attempt to kind of put, there's a darker power behind magic in this one. And I kind of like the vibe with this one, but it does kind of change it. Dungeon Crawl Classics, basically, behind every magic user, there is a dark patron providing it. Now, for people like elves and the silver magic using people like Jonti and all those, it's a more benign relationship. And it's not so benign. And the darker you go from the deep one, the great old ones have given you their attention. And you must go into the world and use your power to spread their influence. And it also comes from, you know, fiendish powers and dark pacts made before you were born. Or ones that you made yourself. I pledge myself to the powers of the Infernal Planes so that I may gain... Eldritch Blast! Yeah! Look out! I got Eldritch Blast! Bam! 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 I'm going to cast Eldritch Blast! I got it. It was great. Great the first 1,700 times you cast it. And it's still good the 1,701st time I cast it! Yeah, they're running. They're cackling maniacally. But, yeah. You get Eldritch Blast for... I sold my soul for Eldritch Blast. Yeah. They got a t-shirt. And then... The last one we want to bring out on this comparison through the ages is none other than the Bard. Now, in 1st edition, when you saw Bard, you opened the door and called him Sir. Excuse me, can I open the door
for you? Yeah, with like their combined like 10 levels of experience just to have gotten to that moment. Like, yeah, I'm a Bard. Whoa, okay. Yeah, that is awesome. Like, what level? I'm a 7th level bard. Holy cats. Yeah. Like a man. That is like the guy who I was a crew mechanic and then I met the Navy SEAL, you know.
Okay.
Dude, awesome. High five. You are the best. That like the bard in old school was to the rest of the adventurers like wow, you have seen some stuff.
Yeah, you've been through it. And then they made the bard, horny and more musically. And yeah. I do better. I do gooder music. My music do good? Yeah, okay. So, yeah, and, you know, but the bard is more versatile than before. Before, it was a pain in the butt to even get the title of bard. Then they made a Dragon Magazine article where they said, hey, here's the bard. Play one.
Well,
and
yeah,
it wasn't bad.
The bar to getting in was so high that nobody played a bard. So like they had this class that is a great idea. It's a wonderful concept of the classic Welsh bards of old, and you wanted to incorporate that, but you've set a threshold that is so awe-inspiring that no one is even approaching it. Like if they're already that far down.
Play the 5 path, levels of fighter. Yeah. Now play 7 levels of thief. Now you can advance as a bard. Do I start as like a 8th level bard? No, you start as 1st level.
Yeah, you're back to being basically
a level 1. And you get druid spells.
Level 1 druid who can block hostile sound attacks. Okay. Not a lot of bang for your buck in a group.
Well, they can charm people, legend, lore, adventurers.
So, but I approve of what they did. They made the Bard something that people could start at level one. Like a brand new party, here's a person who gets to be a Bard. Yeah, I disapprove of that.
Second edition, I think, put that on a good fast track. And then now we get to the last one, which is the Cleric and Druid. And so here we are. So the Cleric, well known. I mean, look, if you have gods in your campaign, these are the people who are their spokesmen, their representatives. So obviously, everybody loves clerics. You know, everybody loves to be healed, but not all clerics heal. And I think from first edition, you kind of had the standard, like, hospitaller, Knights Templar kind of idea of a cleric.
Which, judging on the number one category for cleric, the life domain, the, you know, serious players on D&D Beyond still make use of that classic image, which is they are the, you know, shining light here to, you know, stop wounds and drive back evil and light the darkness. The concepts are still winning even now.
Yeah, but here you also have the Tempest domain and War domain. So War priests,
surprisingly tiny percentages for these.
The gods of storms and seas.
I would have thought War domain would do better than 6%.
Oh well, you know, not everybody plays like you do, but yeah, that you fall in that 6% category. Other people look at the cleric as a provider, a healer, and a guide. And that archetype has stuck with us. I think second edition started to move that out with domains. Third edition really fleshed it out with the role of the cleric is more than just the heal bot. They do more, and their expectations of having to carry forth finally the fight. I mean, the war priest was a valid issue in second edition, but they grew up more to be like their gods rather than just a archetype of a medieval monk or a crusading warrior from the Crusades. Yeah, crusading warrior from the Crusades. That would make sense, right? So, but now we reach the final part, the final form of the cleric, which was a subclass called the Druid. And it's always been weird. So why is the Druid so maligned? Is it because Mike has made other people embarrassed to admit that they play a druid? No, I think that the druid itself is kind of an esoteric. If you're going to play a lot of the things that a druid may represent, the forces of nature or the balance, you can do that with a cleric, but the druid has the ability to shapeshift and is more in contact with the very nature of the natural world. And that makes it a bit of a harder approach and a more stylized approach, which I think the druid has always become. It's always been, I should say. I don't think it's become that. I think it's always been that, I would say. Misspoke there. So, yeah, that's the druid. I mean, you want to talk about Bert's bees, wax, that guy, you know, yeah, that's my druid. That's the guy who's Bert's bees. He's there. that's what my druid
is. Bert's damn bees.
But we're going to put a sideline. Mike's been squirming and biting at the, chomping at the bit here.
Yeah, I mean, we burned like a full 50 minutes on
Baldur's Gate study. Is just, this is a side-by-side comparison. So this is the end note. You know, the whole point is we're looking at the classes and we're talking about them. So, yeah, Baldur's Gate compares this with
completely different results here, okay? Yeah. Radically different. All right. So much so that I really wanted to get into this and talk about, like, here is the difference between D&D Beyond and the massive holistic experience that is the recent arrival of Baldur's Gate 3. And we're looking at a very different spin on the class choices people have made. Scroll that down.
All right. Well, okay.
Yeah. Number one with a bullet, with room to spare, the Paladin. I don't get it. You know, I think part of this is that it is a game that lends itself particularly to solo play. And I find it interesting that so many people in solo play went paladinly. Like, they chose to go mega heroic.
Yeah, there's oaths and all that. So, yeah, the Paladin with its mighty powers and self-heal lends itself well, as also the Divine Champion abilities. They, you know, saving throws and all that are well increased. And since the dice are not off screen and they are here, you get to see the direct results of that. So I think the Paladin is a good reason why a lot of people play this, because if you're strategizing, min-maxing, the Paladin hits all the right, or checks all the right boxes, as the kids say. It is self-healing. It is relatively self-sufficient. It has a high damage output.
A lot of
good leadership and interaction abilities due to the charisma.
Yeah, the charisma to be able to influence social situations while tactically being able to make use of moderately strong and or heavy armor, depending on the feats you follow up with.
Yeah,
and then it's got a really terrific array of weapons as well coming out of the gate, and it makes sense, but it threw me for a loop. I expected fighters again. And instead, we got very specifically the Paladin. And the just plain fighter does not show back up until midway in.
Right, but right after the Paladin is now the Sorcerer, because again...
Yeah, unlike the Rogue, as in our last one, where it was fighters and then Rogues, here we got Paladins and then Sorcerers.
Because the Sorcerer, you get a bloodline that gives you a number of abilities and... built-in spell utility, and yeah, you may not have the versatility of a wizard, having like any spell that I come across I can potentially learn and harness. No, a sorcerer doesn't get that ability. They get ones that they can only choose from their bloodline or their heritage, and ones that are not, they get a certain amount of free picks, of course, but there is some versatility to it, but once you are locked into that, you can't change it out until you level up higher. So yeah, sometimes you're going to be stuck with spells that you no longer want to use. I'm still at Dimension Door, but I want to teleport. Well, you got to wait.
That's what scrolls are for.
But yeah, you can cast and cast Magic Missile until you're blue in the face. You like Magic Missile? You better, because you're going to see this spell a whole lot. You're going to get very familiar with this.
I got a whole bag full of them, and I'm handing them out like puffy stickers.
Yeah, I'm going to take my higher spell slots and convert them to Magic Missile spell slots just to keep casting Magic Missile. And hot on the heels is the Warlock. Now, it is, I say hot on the heels, it's a direct third, but the Warlock is pretty much the same thing as we just showed with the evolution of the Warlock in the D&D game. And then, you know, very close is the Rogue and Bard and Barbarian. Yeah, they all come back, and now we come to the Fighter Ranger.
We get to a median range where, like, there's a very close association between Rogue, Bard, Barbarian, Fighter, Wizard, Monk, and Druid. Like, they all seem to fall in within just a percentage or two of each other, being roughly equal in popularity, with just the saddest story at the end. Unlike in the previous poll for D&D Beyond, the Cleric is just, wow.
Yeah, the Cleric is really the lowest one there because, well... For min-maxing, the Cleric doesn't bring a whole lot to the table. It doesn't check a lot of those boxes we talked about.
Again,
self-healing is there. However, you're very limited unless you have very specific deities. And the deities of Forgotten Realms, while there are a few like Tempest, Tyr, and Torm that do lend themselves to war, they're not specifically, you know, understand the concept. And I think that leaves those concepts, of those deities, that leaves the Cleric at the list.
If you're fighting a lot of undead, Lathander, always a winner.
Yep.
But again, I feel like there is not a strong justification for the total dump that happened here. You get Shadowheart as a Cleric at the beginning of the story. So I'm thinking... that this gives people who are playing Baldur's Gate 3 specifically a reason to, like, well, I don't need to bother with a Cleric. I have one of those, and they're central to the plot. And
exactly, yeah.
I don't want to be, like, two Clerics on the road together.
It's like a buddy film. Bob Hope and Bing Crosby.
Yes, exactly. We're on the clerical road to Tangiers,
the Waterdeep, yeah.
The road to Marrakesh. No, it does not pan out well because, frankly, those skill sets, like you can't build clerics in a way that they radically fill in other skill needs. Okay,
they have some abilities that are nice, but you can't utilize them.
I think that's what's wounding the cleric there. I feel like that was unfair. But
the NPC choice, Shadowheart is there. But then there's the druid. It's higher than the cleric, and I think there's a reason for that, but you already know what I'm going with. It's unbearable, but
you know, Oh, I can't bear any more of it. Oh, boy. No.
It's a bear.
I've had some great times playing Baldur's Gate 3 in, like, the wee hours of the morning when I get out of work. And, like, it's just, man, I don't get anywhere near as much time in as I would like, though. When this season of extreme labor is over, then I will have leisure time.
Yeah, but to bring, putting the flaps down, the wheels down now, we're coming in. I think the reason why some of these class choices are also altered by some of the dynamics. You can always get a sorcerer or wizard later on. The paladin is just basically for the min-maxer. It's the ultimate min-maxer class that always has been. And that's the comparison I wanted to make with the Baldur's Gate. It's like a lot of the class choices that are there that are data mined. Yeah. And you don't just get the casual, you don't get the elite gamer, you get the casual, because this is data mining.
Well, in my moderate difficulty playthrough, the first thing I drafted was a Dragonborn Paladin. Why? Because I wanted to have a character class that is not represented in the available NPCs that pop up throughout the game, and I wanted to play something that had the greatest degree of usefulness so that I could shuffle the party behind me and experience a wider range of gameplay at moderate difficulty without diminishing my functionality. So yeah, there was a min-maxer kind of mentality, a munchkin gamer, although I haven't stripped it right down to the nuts and bolts and like sucked the joy out of it.
Min-maxing doesn't suck the joy out. What it does is it diminishes other people's enjoyment of the game. And in a solo game, you don't have to worry about other people having table time. So
yeah,
I think exactly. That's why... I didn't spend a lot of time because we need to lay the groundwork, as always, to talk about our experiences in playing D&D through the years and how classes have changed. And specifically, I think one of the biggest ones that's changed, of all the classes we talked about, the one that's had the biggest change is the Bard. And, you know, there's a big comeuppance on that, that the Bard has become a better character class to play through the years. Yeah. But we have like beaten your eardrums to death, and so it's time to give you a
hour
rest.
And a half.
Yeah, so it's all right. We're here for it, and you were here with us. So if you made it to the end, congratulations. You were no prizes in the mail. But on that note, we're going to sign off, and we'll see you next time. But remember,
may the dice always roll in your favor.
We're out.
See ya.